where your living quarters have got some altitude. And now that antenna, although it's in a not so great environment, at least it's got some altitude working for it. And you'll get out. You'll work. But when you put an antenna inside of a private home, the chances of it coupling into the toaster, the microwave oven, the phonograph, the VCR player, the telephone, the television, and so on, drastically goes up. So why put yourself under that disadvantage is my first approach. Why use the constraints of an automobile in your home? It'll work. Lots of guys, for instance, get on 2 meters and 440 by taking a mag mount and sticking it to the refrigerator. It's a very good antenna. In the case of VHF, there the amount of real estate you've got in the automobile is not such a restriction. But when it comes to HF, the automobile is such a constraining environment that I'm hesitant to use that kind of an antenna inside of a home. That's my first impression. That's an opinion. But I bet you Mel's done things like this, and I bet you he's got a better answer. K2KEY, K2RIW.
No, he doesn't want to put it in the house, the mobile antenna. Maybe he misunderstood the way I read it. In other words, he's got this mobile antenna that he takes off, and he wants to use it on his patio. He has a patio deck or something off the house, and he wants to use the mobile antenna, and he wants to get another one equivalent to the same mobile antenna that he has, a second one, and some way put them in a dipole configuration and use that as a multi-band antenna. In other words, if he took two mobile antennas and put them back to back, you know, fed them, made some kind of mounting gadget that he could put together and then fed it, would that make a viable dipole to put out on a patio deck? And I think they've got some kind of those antennas that's similar to that. In other words, want to take advantage of that he owns really half the antenna system, that if he gets another mobile antenna like that, in other words, and use it outside at the house on the deck as a, I guess you can call it a rotatable dipole deck, over.
I heard Glenn, but Glenn, you're extremely noisy tonight. You'll have to move that handy-talkie to another location. Without a doubt, you recognize the fact that every dipole is really a pair of monopole antennas back-to-back. And that mobile antenna is a kind of a monopole antenna. So a pair of them back-to-back will work like a charm. There's a catch. You could take your transmitter power output, put it through a power divider, and feed half the power to each one of these antennas being used back-to-back as a dipole. But the other catch is you've got to feed them 180 degrees out of phase. So you've got to either use a 180-degree power divider. There are a few designs like that. Or after the power divider, you've got to make one length of cable half wavelength longer than the other cable to feed these two back to back. They've got to be fed exactly 180 degrees out of phase. To do that on multiple bands represents a switching network that's a little bit of a pain. If you're doing it on just one band, 20 meters, and you tune it up for that one band, and you make one piece of cable half wavelength longer on 20 meters than the other, which I guess is something in the vicinity of, a half wave in free space on 20 meters is around 32 feet, if I did that correction. With the velocity factor of the cable, it's going to come out like 25 feet. So 25 feet of extra cable on 20 meters feeding one antenna versus the other would do it. So a little bit of a lot of rigmarole. Mobile antennas tend to be expensive. To buy a pair of them to connect to your patio, I'm a little reluctant. It'll work, but there are better ways of doing it with less expense and more performance, in my opinion. Let's see if Glenn has come back with a stronger signal. KC2QIQ and the group, K2RIW.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Good evening, everybody on the net tonight. Yeah, I've done this experiment, Dick, with a pair of Tar Heels, and I've used it on the car very, very successfully, just making sure, first, the ground is very, very good on the car, getting a very, very thick braid and mounting it to the body. But then again, when I tried putting it up on the house and then mounting it up on a tall mast, I couldn't get it to tune at all on a single element. Then I brought it very, very close to the ground with a very, very short piece of pipe terminated into the ground, on a one-inch piece of pipe, basically only about a foot off of the ground level. And the low-end performance, you know, it's 80 meters, 40 meters, worked pretty darn well. 10 meters, the antenna was just too low to really get any kind of performance. Then I tried, I do have two of them, and I kind of had to come up with a strange wiring for the controller that controls, so I could get both of them to go up at the same time and count and come down at the same time and count, and I was able to get that to work too, and use them in a dipole configuration. And there's enough range, tuning range on the motorized coils that you can actually get, between a 50 to 75 ohm dip in the, where you can just use a single piece of coax, connect the center conductor on one side, the ground on the other side, and get it to tune by just moving the coils in and out, and eventually you can get it to work. But there again, it was just too close to the ground and I couldn't get enough height on it. And anything that comes within the near field of that antenna, because it's naturally a shortened antenna, the pattern was pretty awful, and I just really couldn't get the response I was looking for out of it. I have to agree with you. I think that there's a much better way of operating than using that very expensive technique and relatively poor performer. Over to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ. Just an opinion.
About that idea? Yeah, hold on to that one, Alex. Hey, that's real hard, hands-on experience you've got there, Glenn. And if I understand you correctly, because you were using one as the resonator for the other, you only fed one of them, and the other one was left inert just as a resonator. Very crafty. And I guess you could rotate it also, and you tuned them together. Again, very crafty. But I guess you're saying because it was low to the ground, you didn't get a great deal of performance. Back to you, Glenn, for any fill on that.
And it was also, unless you do it with some kind of like an insulated mast to hold it off in clamping arrangement, any kind of metal or anything that even gets close to it, because it's such a shortened antenna on those frequencies, the performance is very erratic. When it's mounted to a car, it's very different for some reason, against the car body. But there again, the ground is critical. You have to get a nice short ground, get it as close to the chassis mount as you can possibly get it, and they tune pretty nicely. The best configuration was actually just using one into a piece of pipe on the ground level. And I think for 40 and 80, granted, you know, they are expensive antennas, and the controller wire is going to have to be pretty long, too. I mean, let's face it, you know, you might have to run, you know, 50, 100 foot of length of wire back to a total power supply and a controller to move it up and down, plus the coax. It's not a very pretty, you know, it's very expensive. You figure it's a $400 antenna plus another 100 something for the controller, and you can see where it goes from there. It's not a very pretty situation. Back over to you, Dick.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like you get your best bang for the dollar out of that approach. It'll work, but I'm not sure that you're it's a cost-effective way of doing it. Alex, what would you do instead? N2NMU, K2RIW?
First, a comment that a mobile station is fully isolated from the ground. The station and the feeders and its ground plane are not connected to the ground. They're all floating. That's not the case when you put the power supply on in the outlet and you use your transmitter as such. So this is why the antenna is behaving differently. But if I would be that chap, I would use it as a two-element phased array antenna. It will be much simpler, and it will get some directivity out of it. Back to your dig.
Yeah, but that antenna is made to go on a large metallic object like the frame of an automobile. What's the best way he can create a pair of frames for these two-element interferometer on the porch of his house? He wants to mount these pair of antennas on the porch of his house. How would you do that, Alex? Go ahead.
As I said, he cannot emulate the automobile because once he sticks his transmitter into outlet, the whole ground issue goes away. Actually, it comes crushing on him. When you're using a transmitter into a mobile, the whole thing is fully ground isolated. Everything is floating. So unless he's using an isolated power supply, he cannot emulate the mobile station. Anyhow, I used successfully for a period of time 1 meter square of aluminum sheet under the antenna, and that get me on the 10 meter band without any problem.
Okay, that's a possible approach. Back to you, Mel, K2KEY, K2LIW.
Very good. That's, like you say, it's doable, but most likely there are somewhat simpler or even cheaper ways of accomplishing. I know they are selling antennas, however, let me put the final word. I believe I've seen antennas advertised. I don't remember, you know, really, and most I skimmed over, not having a heck of a lot of interest, but I believe they have some multi-band type of rotatable dipoles that go on tripods that supposedly cover the HF amateur radio bands. Anybody could say anything about that that's on frequency? Over.
It's called a buddy pole. B-U-D-D-Y, buddy pole.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, it's just, you know, along with what Alex is saying, but, I mean, those screwdriver antennas are not cheap, and they're really, you're paying all this money for a mobile antenna that's going to tune from 10 to 80. To get it to tune over that range in a house, unless you actually have it on the ground or you use another one as the, you know, it's like the counterpoise version of it, it's going to be extremely difficult to get it. And anything that comes within the near field of that antenna, because it's a shortened antenna, it's going to have a wicked effect on its performance. The other thing, too, is if you add a piece of aluminum, now you've limited it to 10 meters. But, I mean, if you're going to do that, why not just use a CB antenna, which costs, like, you know, less than $100, and you can shorten it a little bit, and basically now you've got a 10-meter vertical that'll cover just about all of the 10-meter band. Back over to you, Dick, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, Mel and Glenn and Alex and Rich, I can see where this guy is going. When it comes to some of the modern equipment you can put in your car, like a tape deck player or a DVD player or whatever, to transport it from the automobile, plug it into the appropriate fixture in the house, and now use that hi-fi equipment in the house, sharing equipment between car and house is very convenient in some areas. But when it comes to the antenna you put on the car, such a restricted environment, that's a tough way to go. A piece of wire that you string as a dipole, if it's a small enough diameter wire of the right color, it can be made vertical to a tree, strung between trees, between tower and tree and whatever. We amateurs see wire. The general public does not see wire. So when you put up dipoles around your house, you can get a lot of performance, and it's an almost invisible antenna. And so to transport the rig, the transmitter itself, with its beautiful synthesizer and receiver and whatever and display, to move it from the automobile and plug it into something in the house, and then plug it into the coax cable that goes to a dipole that's somewhere above the house, that's a beautiful arrangement. There you're sharing the equipment between car and house and getting a lot of performance. And that dipole antenna in the backyard strung in the trees is a couple of dollars worth of hardware, which will have 20 decibels more performance in some cases compared to a mobile antenna down at ground level. I mean, just because the mobile antenna is expensive, common sense would lead you to believe, hey, it's going to have a lot of performance. And the fact that something that's 1/100th the cost, a dipole of wire in the trees, can have 10 times more performance and 1/100th the cost, that's hard to believe. It might be the reality. So that could give you a suggestion of a better way to go, in my opinion. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Very good. This is K2KEY. Now, Rich just mentioned an antenna. Not really that familiar with. I believe he said buddy pole. Buddy pole. Okay. Sounds like a great name. I think I may have seen it advertised. Rich, could you say a few more words about it? You seem to be familiar with it. Is it a recommended antenna for this gentleman rather than buy himself, say, another mobile antenna? Is it somewhat price-wise or whatever would be compatible? Rich, over.
Melon to Leo. You know who used to use one? With Norman, K2YEW. He used the buddy pole. And I remember going on their website. You could Google buddy pole. I think it's two words. Yeah, it's two words, not one word. It's basically, guy sells a dipole that sits on a tripod. And you can tune it up for any band. It's made for portable, it's made for hilltopping, that sort of thing. Probably the best thing. I think it's about $100 and something.
Word, and to RSO. It's a RSO, go right ahead. Start with your name, we should know it. And to RSO, go ahead.
Okay, I'll copy, okay?
Copy, we're copying you very well.
Okay, good evening, Dick. Buddy Paul is spelled B-U-D-D-I-P-O-L-E. It's one word. Their website is very simple. www.buddypaul.com. And I have a friend in the Wantour Club who bought one. They're not cheap. I think the whole system is about $200. But he swears by it. He says it's a terrific system. It can be set up as a portable dipole in either a flat top inverted V or full V configuration or even an L. It comes with an assortment of coils, and you can go from 6 meters to 80, I believe. Back to Net and to RSO.
Frank, have you used one, or how many of your friends have used it, and how happy are they with it?
Just one friend, Dick, who owns one, and he's extremely happy with it. He takes it with him when he goes up to Vermont, fishing, camping, whatever. I have experimented with hamstick dipoles, utilizing a dipole adapter, and have it on a tripod mast going up anywhere from 10 to 15 feet and connected to an external automatic coupler such as the ICOM AH4 and or the SGC 230-237. They're all pretty similar and all work very nicely.
I see from QRZ.com, Frank, that you were, up until 11 years ago, in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and Emergency Management Specialized and Chief Emergency Radio Operator and so on. I'll bet you in that environment you guys have used a number of ruggedized antennas that can be used on the move or rapidly set up in various locations. I'd love to hear you give us a couple of words on what kind of antennas Army Corps of Engineers was using under your command, and would any of those be helpful for our kind of field day operations? N2RSO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. The one HF antenna that we used almost exclusively, at least in the New York district, was the B&W folded dipole. Many clubs, including my Wantour Club, use it for field day. It's approximately 90 feet from end to end, and it folds over, goes from 10 to 160 meters. No coupler or antenna tuner required, although it can help. And I know you're familiar with the antenna. It's basically not sure whether it's a 9-to-1 ballon at the bottom and approximately a 600-ohm resistor at the top. And we found it very effective. As a matter of fact, there's still one on the roof of the federal building in Manhattan where I used to work, and one on the post office building nearby where the Corps of Engineers division used to be. They had theirs in a different configuration. They had theirs as a sloper. And both work very well and seem to be pretty much the standard with the Army Corps of Engineers. One exception, our net control station in Mississippi had a gigantic log periodic that they used and beamed at both the east and west coasts. I hope that answers your questions, and I hope I didn't time out. Back to Ned and to RSO.
No, good information, Frank. Thank you. I should know and I don't know. Is that antenna still manufactured today at BMW, Brown and Williamson? I think it is a folded dipole. If so, what's your guess as to the approximate selling price of that antenna assembly today? Most likely you've used the ones that have been around for 20 years. You might not know if it's still manufactured in the current price, but you happen to, I'd like to know about it. N2RSO, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick, it's still manufactured. It's Barker and Williamson, and they make it in various configurations. They have shortened versions, and their mainstay is the 90-foot length. My one complaint is that they use copper weld wire. And as you know, it's steel wire coated with copper, and it's a copper clad device. The problem with it is that it kinks very easily, and if you nick or scratch it in any location, eventually the steel underneath the copper will be subjected to the elements and will rust and break. I have one at home which is actually a BMW that was thrown away by my organization. They threw it in the garbage because of the rusting of the wire, and they put up a new one. I retrieved it from the garbage, brought it home, saved the Balun and the 600 ohm resistor, and I restrung it with flex weave, and it turns out to be a very effective wire in that configuration and very easy to handle. Back to Ned and to RSM.
Interesting piece of information. So you have to treat the copper weld with tender loving care, not to nick it anywhere. Otherwise, you're going to affect the longevity. The flex wire that you use as a substitute, who sells that product and what's the approximate cost of that? Frank, go ahead.
So your first question about price. The original BMW folded dipole sold for $199.95. I believe it's now up to somewhere between $250 and $299. They've raised the price, obviously, because the price of copper has gone up. Flexweave is not a cheap wire. It's sold by various companies such as The Wire Man, who's on the internet. I believe he's based in Virginia. And I'm sure you'll find it advertised in QST and CQ magazine, various ads in the back, cable experts, companies like that. Occasionally you'll find rolls at Hamfests. I believe I picked up some at a Limark Hamfest a few years ago, but it's not a common wire to find.
Okay, flex weave, that's a new one on me, Frank, and I'm not an HF person. Is it multiple strands of enameled wire? Is it an antenna equivalent of Litz wire? If I saw a roll of flex weave, how would I recognize it? What would it look like? And sounds like a very handy material for flexible antenna wires that don't have fatigue failure. Some people have been successful with a 14-gauge household wire strung up in the air, and some people, particularly in the case of cubicle quads, have experienced quite a bit of fatigue failure at the corners, and maybe flex weave would be a beautiful substitute in that case. So what does flex weave look like, Frank? N2RSO, K2 KQIYW. Sorry to keep you so long.
No problem, Vic. The flex weave is, you know, at first inspection, it looks like ordinary stranded wire, but if you take a close look at it, you'll find that the strands are much finer than normal stranded wire. And instead of being twisted, it's actually woven together. I guess it's analogous to the way clothesline rope is woven. It is extremely flexible. As a matter of fact, they advertise the fact that you can hook up an antenna very quickly with no soldering, no clamping. You simply loop one end of the flex weave through an insulator and tie a knot in it. Hopefully a double knot, but that's how flexible it is. You can connect it to almost anything that way.
Interesting material. Mel, have you ever heard of flex weave? Have your progressive guys from the Kings County Radio Club used it on some of your field day sites? K2KEY, K2RIW.
KC2QIQ with a comment?
Yeah. Take 1 second to get to everybody. Yes, I've used flex weave. It's great. It's very good wire. I guess it's considered work hardened copper wire, basically. It's good stuff, I'll tell you, for antennas, really. A little on the pricey side. I haven't used it extensively, but I happen to have a short pieces. I have a dipole, in fact, I think laying in the garage that I was able to put together using it, and used that dipole a couple of times in portable locations. It's a 20-meter dipole made with the flex weave, and the reason I liked it because it, you know, rolls up very neatly into a nice, convenient carrying situation, Dick. But I believe that's because the copper is basically what they... what do they call that copper that's work hardened, Dick, that doesn't stretch over?
So it's work hardened, which ordinarily would be stiff, but because there's a lot of fine strands woven together, somewhat like kern-mantled rope or like clothesline rope, you end up with a product that's highly conductive and very flexible. Good combination. I heard both Glenn and Alex in that order. Glenn, KC2QIQ, go ahead.
Dick, I've seen the flex wire. I've used it here in the past. It's very, very similar to the Litz wire, except it doesn't have any insulation on it. Most of the Litz wire that I've handled usually has some kind of like dielectric insulator between each of the individual leads, where this flex wire is built a very, very similar way, but it doesn't have any insulation on it. I also have an additional question, but let Alex go first, and if you want to pick me up on that one, thanks.
So with a comment?
Who is that with comment?
Frank RSO. I just wanted to mention that the flex weave, the original one came non-insulated, but it is now available in PVC insulated and polyethylene insulated as well. Anyone wants more information, I suggest going to www.radioworks.com/cwire. That's cwire.html. RadioWorks has a pretty good selection of flex weave, the various versions, and they range in price from 22 cents a foot to 47 cents a foot, depending on whether it's insulated and the type of insulation, and 2 RSO.
Thank you, Frank. Sounds like a nice material to build dipole-like antennas out of. And 2NNU, go right ahead, Alex.
Oh, finally, I know what I'm using here. I really didn't know what that 500-foot spool is doing. I thought initially that it is an coax cable rejected because they forgot to put in it the center wire. But now I know what I'm using for my 160-meter band wire hanging to the tree. Wow. leg sleeve. All right, I'm going to have to look for it. I had a 500-foot cable remaining from an electrical installation. I didn't know what it was used for, but they threw it away, so I said, that's a pity. That's good copper. Why I like it, it is styrofoam isolated. It is so soft, it's like a piece of meat. You can take a fistful of it, make it in a fist, and it is feeling very, very soft. Back to you, I think.
That sounds like a beautiful material. Where did you acquire that, Alex?
Wall Street threw away a bunch of equipment, bunch of computers, bunch of wires. If you want wires, you go to Wall Street.
Understand. Okay, is anyone else that wants to make comments on all of the above? Give me your call letters right now. We'll give a nice long delay. Give me 2MAR. WA2MAR. Start with your name and go right ahead with your comment.
Kilo Bravo 2, Mike Montreal. I'm in here, dude. Basically, I was wondering, with the copper weld less noise here on HF than the kind of wire back to you?
Okay, I think you said Kilo Bravo 2, Mike Bravo, Romeo, and you asked a question about wire, but it was so noisy we didn't get it. Want to try again?
I just wanted to know that isn't the copper weld less noisier than the standard type of wire?
Okay, when it comes to Kilo Bravo 2, Mike Bravo, Romeo, is that the call letters you said you had?
Kilo Bravo 2, Mike Alpha, Romeo.
Okay, now we got you, Gabriel Yonkers. And quite a noisy signal. The noise that you're probably worried about when it comes to a repeater service is a very different kind of noise than you would worry about when it comes to a dipole antenna. To make scratchy contacts and noise on a dipole antenna, that's pretty hard to do. If you think about the number of wavelengths you've got between the individual strands, your eye may think that they are separated by some significant difference, distance, but to a radio wave, they're not. So as long as the point of contact, like say, for instance, you're bringing the ends of a dipole made out of flex weave or whatever, you're bringing it to the eye bolts that are on a balloning device that's going to hang from your tree, and your coax cable connects to the bottom of it. To really do a good job, you would tie some kind of a knot there, and the end of the flex weave would be soldered to the tab that you've got in that area to make sure you've got good electrical contact. A very exacting person would worry about the individual strands scraping against the eye bolt that they're tied through, and the solder joint that's nearby would really pick up that joint, if you know what I mean. So for most of our HF frequencies, as long as there isn't something making and breaking contact with the whole antenna itself, like rubbing against the tower, that's bad news. But within the wire strands themselves and the way they make contact, you've got to really go some to make a lot of radio noise in that area on HF frequencies, in my opinion. Back to you, Gabe. KB2MAR, KQLIW.
So some of the manufacturers say that the solid copper weld would be less noisier. So now you're telling me that even though the flex weave, there's so many strands that it wouldn't make an extra noise. Well, if you tell me, I mean, obviously I'm going to do much more than the manufacturer would, you know? Back to you.
Well, be careful, Dave. Mel and I do our best, but we've got a certain hit ratio. We make mistakes from time to time. I haven't done the experiment of flex weave versus a copper weld and which one creates more noise. I haven't done the experiment. I'm telling you what my experience is telling me in this particular environment. And I could be wrong. I'm giving you a strongly felt opinion. And let's see if Mel knows of people who have used flex weave or anyone else. Have they ever run into any noise with that, with the individual strands rubbing against each other? Radio wavelength-wise, they're so darn close. in the conductivity of the material is the darn high for it to make scratchy noise at the contacts, I think is very unlikely, but I wouldn't bet my life on it. I would only I'd only bet 97% of my money on that that particular opinion, if you know what I mean. See what Mel's going to say. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. No, this I have never run across any antenna wire, whether it be house type, you know, regular wire number, like you say, number 12, 14 wire stranded or whatever, or any of that wire of any sort, whether it be flex weave, copper weld, that have in any way, produced some kind of a static noise from rubbing together. I've never seen any mention of it, nor ever have I heard of any discussions on it, Dick. Over.
Yeah, I've had a partial failure with my inverted V dipole support structure, where one of the strands of the inverted V dipole was rubbing against the Rhone tower, and that made noise. But that's a severe situation where the antenna itself is rubbing against a grounded structure. But shy of that, I think this is not to worry about. Yeah, because you got to look at it wavelength-wise is the first way to look at it, and the fact that you're not transmitting and receiving. I will admit that if FlexWeave was used on an antenna that was used in full duplex repeater service, where all the intermods have got to be 150 dB down, yes, there it could give you trouble. But very few of us on an HF frequency transmit and receive simultaneously on essentially the exact same frequency on the exact same antenna at one time. Very few of us. I know that the guys at the Swampscott VHF Society, W1BU, Mr. Sam Harris himself, used to do that. He would get on the HF band saying, "Hello, CQ, CQ, please answer me while I'm talking on this frequency, and I will answer you." He had the ability to do that with separate antennas and filters and directional couplers and whatever. I mean, he got a real big kick out of the fact that he could call CQ until somebody answered him. And while he was calling CQ, he would say, "Answer me on this frequency while I'm talking, and I will hear you." And it was fascinating to hear him call CQ. Somebody piles on top of him, talks to him, and he answers the guy without a QSY, without a frequency shift. So if you've got the right kind of technology, that can be done. In that particular circumstance, maybe FlexWeld would give Sam Harris a little bit of a problem. But the rest of us mortals, where our feet touch the ground and we don't do that kind of very high technology ham radio, I think this is probably not a problem. We probably got room for another letter if you think you got another good one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
K2QIQ with a question if you have time for it.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Kind of goes back to a question that I was asking before about boom lengths and gain on Yagis. And an antenna that's really kind of caught my eye for a while, last few years, and I haven't bought one yet, and I'm dying to, but I'm trying to model this thing, and it's the Step IR, and they have an antenna. It's in the recent version of QST, you can look it up. They call it the Dream Beam 18E. It's basically a three-element, it looks like, you know, just by looking at a picture of it, it looks like three folded dipoles, and I think most of us understand how the Step IR tunes. But the odd part about it is it's on a fixed boom, and the boom is 18 feet long. Now, what we know about Yagis and how they work, you know, yes, you can tune across the band, tune all the elements, but how do they get such great performance out of it? I mean, I've heard so many of them on the air, and they work phenomenally, but you would think that there's some kind of, like, gain loss as you go over wide frequency range. I mean, they say it tunes continuously here. Just from this, I think they're talking about somewhere like between 6 meters all the way down to like 40 meters, basically with continuous motorized tuning on those elements. But what about the boom length on that? What's actually going on with the gain? You know, one would think that, you know, you're losing tremendous gain as you're shifting and doing all that tuning. Is there something else going on there?
Yeah, I think I see where you're going here, Glenn. If I was designing a ultimate performance 15-element Yagi on some VHF, UHF frequency, I would probably start off with either the K1FO design, Steve Polishin, or I would start off with the Gunter Hawk DL6WU design. There you'll find out there is some very specific spacing between all of the parasitic elements, and each of the parasitic elements has a particular length for a particular diameter in order to give full performance, where you get a nice clean forward pattern. First side lobe 17.5 dB down, second side lobe 22 dB down. Those, by the way, are the magic numbers that give you maximum gain. That's another whole issue. And I've written an article on that you can read about. Where can you read that one? I guess in Roadrunner's microwave group, I think there's an article on that one. The so-called KQRIW corner of Roadrunner's K5RMG, Roadrunner's microwave group, Northern Texas. They collect these things that I've published on the web over the years, and they got them all in one spot, at least many of them. Anyhow, so there's an optimum number of wavelengths of spacing between the parasitic elements and the length of the parasitic elements for a long Yagi. If now I restrict my thinking to only three element Yagis, one driven element, one reflector, one director, let me drop, and if I choose some kind of an intermediate spacing between those, and if I've got complete freedom to change the length of the parasitic element and the driven element, now the gain sacrifice that you form because you don't have exactly the right spacing, that's a much lower Q antenna, and the exact right spacing between the elements is nowhere near as critical. It is my guess that they're able to, across that frequency range, get 85% or so of the performance of a three-element Yagi if it was optimized in boom blend for each of those frequencies, even though they're not changing it. If this is the best of all worlds, the stepper IR would have not only stepper motors that change the length of the elements, but also have another set of stepper motors that would change the spacing between the elements. That would be the most ideal. But that would be a very elaborate, not-so-reliable arrangement. So, with three-element Yagis, you can get away with murder. You can have those three elements extremely close or extremely far in spacing, and if you retune the length of the parasitic elements accordingly, you'll get 85% or so, or 90% of the performance you would get if it was optimized. Three-element Yagi is very forgiving, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of suspecting, because, I mean, I've heard so many of these, stepper IRs, beams on the air, and they're really gangbusters. I mean, you can talk to somebody on 20, they'll QSY up to, another band, and boy, it's amazing how well they perform across bands. You can reverse direction on them. Certainly a very interesting antenna, but to actually sit down and analyze them, very, very strange, but I think I see what you mean by, because it's only a three-element beam, that the spacing requirements aren't as critical. Thanks for the explanation, Nick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Those are fairly pricey antennas. I would guess they start off in the $700 category. Is that true, Glenn, for one that goes either 20 or 40 meters?
This one I'm looking for. They're showing two here in the QST magazine. One of them is the, they call the DreamBeam 18, and that's got a list price on here of $25.50. And then they show the other one, the DreamBeam E, underneath it for $29.50. So that's like $3,000, Dick. Oof. That's kind of steep, but when you hear these things on the air, wow, they are kind of the cat's meow. Back over to you, Dick.
If I buy the plain vanilla, bare bones, two-element or three-element stepper antenna, roughly how many dollars is that one, Glenn?
Well, out of the beams, I only know of these two that are being produced right now. There might be more, but the two that I know of is this DreamBeam 18, and the other one's the DreamBeam 18E, and the pricing... there again, I think at one time when they first came out, if you look at the two outside elements, the difference between the 18 and the 18E is the 18 has what looks like a dipole element in the middle, and it has what look like the folded dipoles as the reflector and the directing element. So the driven looks almost like a standard dipole. On the DreamBeam 18E, it looks like three folded dipoles. Not that I'm saying that they're folded dipoles, but they're motorized antennas, but they have that appearance, like a folded dipole deck. And that's like $3,000.
Do you have time for a question?
Let me go back to this one. Glenn, if the individual parasitic element and the driven element are not dipole elements, I mean, inside of those fiberglass tubes, they've got a piece of copper tape with tractor feed holes on it. And there's a stepper motor working on those tractor feed holes, paying it out. How do you pay out a folded dipole? Mechanically, I'm having trouble visioning that one. Back to you, Glenn.
Well, the way I've seen these right now is it has the appearance of a folded dipole, but I don't think that's really what's going on inside of it. In other words, right now it's you know what a folded dipole looks like. It's got an elongated oval, you know, where the two pieces almost are like running parallel and like loops on either end. And the motor is on one side, so what they basically are doing is they're feeding this length out from like a spool, almost like the way that the mobile retractable antennas work on a car, except instead of moving the dielectric to lift the mechanical elements up and down, it's basically spooling it out and rolling it through this like tubular length. So, and they're doing it with all three elements, with three separate stepper motors, and so it's kind of like rolled up, and then it kind of like spools and feeds it out through that tube. It's a very, very interesting kind of a design.
Is there a turnaround on each end, and does that turnaround point move with the spooling functions?
I'm not really sure. I've never owned one. I've never taken one apart. So I know what I have right now is from some of the descriptions that I've seen of them and some of the explanations I've heard from people on air. But I don't know. I really don't have the right answer for that one, Dick.
Interesting. Rich, N2EO, go right ahead with your question.
Hey, thank you, Dick. I'm sorry for getting in here late. I fell asleep earlier this afternoon and woke up maybe about an hour and a half ago. Dick, one of the things I sent you in an email, I purchased, if you go on eBay, go to the ham radio section, but the electronics in general, and type in frequency standard. You were talking about frequency standards last week. Much to my surprise, you'll find rubidium standards in there. I bought one from China. It was under $200, and it'll be coming probably in about a week or so. It's got actual rubidium in it. I wonder what you think of the safety of a thing like that. And I wonder if you're familiar with it. It's a module. This one is programmable from 2 hertz to 20 megahertz with a computer. You can program it for a time base of any frequency you want. I'm going to program it for 10 megahertz because I'm going to use it for a master clock on a frequency counter and on a WaveTech 3000B station monitor, you know, service monitor. Back to that, M2EO.
Yes, I went to that website and I saw that foreign-made rubidium standard. More than half of the Sirius microwave portable operators in California, the guys on 10 gigs and 20 gigs and 40 gigs, are using rubidium standards. So the idea of a rubidium frequency standard to make sure that everybody's on the same frequency to the nearest hertz. They're getting one part in 10 to the 10 accuracy out of these things in the field. So, as I said, half of the Sirius microwave operators in California are using these things. Very few of us on the East Coast are using them yet. We may catch up. Now, are they all using the same brand? Do they all pay the same price? That I don't know. But the concept of a rubidium standard is a good one, well proven in the field. And I believe many of the cell sites have a master frequency clock running on a rubidium standard. So that concept is a good one. The actual amount of rubidium inside is much smaller than the amount you would have in a pill that you would swallow. Very little. It's in a small little class module of its own. And even if rubidium is a dangerous material, don't worry. There's very little of it there. The majority of it's all the electronics that takes that approximately 8 gigahertz signal and counts it down to whatever frequency you want to have as your standard output. Now, that particular model number from China, do I know about that one? No. Do the guys from the San Bernardino Microwave Society know about the goods and bad quirks of that particular one? I'm sure the answer is yes. And if you signed into their particular website, San Bernardino Microwave Society and or North Texas Microwave Society, these are the two groups that are probably familiar with the various brands of rubidium standards. So they could tell you how good that particular model is. Does anybody have experience with it? Are they happy with it? N2EO, K2LIW.
Hey, Dick, very good. Do you think I'm going to have any trouble interfacing that to a service mod? My frequency counter has an external input. My service monitor, which I recently purchased, is a used WaveTech 3000B service monitor. It goes up to 999 megahertz, and I want to lock everything in on one rubidium standard. What I had planned to do was to disconnect the TCXO inside, which is 10 megahertz, plug this in, and I'm wondering if I'll get away with, I believe that unit is 10 megawatts output. Do you think I'll get away with just using a T-connector, two pieces of equipment, a looping through, or do you think I'll have to use some sort of a power divider to...
That's a function of that particular design. If at worst you've got to put an MAR little amplifier into a module that gives you power splitting and then you feed everything in the shack simultaneously, those are minor details of, as I see it, Rich. That's a couple of extra dollars worth of hardware if you've got to do that. However, if they've got a real buffer amplifier in the output and you load it down with a T connector and see 25 ohms instead of 50 ohms, any self-respecting design of a frequency standard, it ain't going to change the frequency simply because you load it with 25 ohms. So I wouldn't worry about that. That's a rather minor detail. We've only got about 2 or 3 minutes left, Mel. I guess we'll start saying 73. This was TechNet number 1,242 of the series that began in September of 1982, way back in the dark ages. Boy, these guys are dedicated. And so, back to you for any closing comments and or anything else you want to say about your mail, Mel. K2KEY. Have a nice week. K2RIW.
Dick, very good. And we'll leave them for next week here. A number of them that I picked out that very interesting. So we'll get to them. Everybody just be sort of patient. And the material that they used as the radioactive, so-called radioactive standard in there. From what I understand, was mentioned that it was smaller than a grain of rice. So I think it really doesn't present any kind of really hazard unless you start pulling apart. But am I, just one question, am I correct in understanding that at one time or still there were smoke detectors that used some kind of radioactive material? Is that correct, Dick? Over.
Yes, to my knowledge, it was, I'm having trouble thinking the name of the stuff right now, but there is a mildly radioactive material that was used in a number of the smoke detectors, and it might still exist for all I know. Polonium, I think it is. Yeah, I think it's polonium, is in a number of the smoke detectors. Very, very small amount of it. If you took four of those smoke detectors, take them apart, and swaddled the material, I think you'd be pushing your luck, but that you'd have to do something that drastic to get into trouble, is my belief, Mel. Go ahead.
Hey, no, I'm just thinking, not to swallow it, but maybe an application that is polonium in any way same as rubidium or cesium in its value as some kind of standard. Over.
I doubt it highly. First of all, cesium and rubidium, I don't think are radioactive. I could be wrong on that one, but they're not the usual radioactive materials. The hyperfine frequency characteristic it has, which allows it to become an extremely accurate standard of frequency, is not due to radioactivity, to my knowledge. It's a kind of molecular resonance of that particular molecule, which is independent of radioactivity. If it was radioactive, then its mass would be changing, and I'd worry that its frequency would be changing. So I doubt it's radioactive. Over to you, Mel.
Good thing for us to discuss next week. I don't know the idiosyncrasies of it, but Rich had mentioned it, and I couldn't really give him an exact direct answer, so we'd be interested to hear what Rich has to say when he gets this device from China. 73s, everybody. We'll catch up with you next week. Thank you very much for the support, and keep the emails coming. We'll do our best to answer as many as possible. 73s, we'll catch you all next week. Stay well.
The time is 12 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Welcome to the New England Reflector, 912.
Channel 6.
The time is 1:23 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, welcome to the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30, W2VL repeater system. Good morning, the time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
W2HKV. Watch on WHUKOP. How's your weekend?
Yeah, weekend was good, George. I was helping a buddy get up a G5RV dipole, getting him on the air. He made his first HF contact from his own little rig there, a GS480, relatively new operator. What else did I do? Little of this, little of that. the bat phone about 30 times with stupid questions from morons operating equipment that don't know how to operate. Then,